Welcome back. As I said, you know, we are talking about leadership, and as I mentioned last time, in this session, I want to just talk about for a moment the fact that there is a price to pay for living out a vision and leading people in a vision. And that price to pay is real. And so I want to talk about it a little bit, just a reminder, when that area of leadership, the leader interacting with the culture to define a preferable future, and then later we're going to get into the planning and the impetus for the planning and prayer that needs to happen to make the vision a reality. But the vision is that star that's going to lead us. It's the star that's going to be the thing we keep in mind as all the other stuff goes on down here. It's the one that's going to be the thing we steer by, like a North Star. And so as we talk about that vision, last time I talked about vision killers. This time I want to talk about the fact that when you are trying to fulfill a vision, there's going to be a price to pay. For you personally, not just for the people, but for you personally. This man has been one of my mentors. His name is Harold Korver. When we were looking at relocation, I remember calling up Harold. He lived about 40 miles from me in Southern California, which means anywhere from a 40-minute drive to a three-hour drive, depending on the time of day. But I called Harold, and I just said, I want to have lunch with you and just bounce some ideas off from you. I would do that on occasion. And so I began to share with him, you know, the fact that we had gotten this vision, this change vision from a building where we were to a relocation to this new area where there was an expected 150,000 people moving into that community. And so we had this opportunity, and we got this great vision of reaching them in the name of Jesus Christ. And it was exciting, but I just wanted to bounce it off from him because I was in that thing of fear, you know. And so he was one of the people I consulted. And so I shared with him, and together we started to look at all the variety of costs that there were going to be for this. You know, there were financial costs, of course, that, you know, the expansion that we're looking at where we were was going to cost somewhere around $2 to $3 million, whereas the relocation was going to cost, who knows, but it was going to be upwards, far above $10 million. We could accurately predict that. And so, there's going to be that cost. But then there were going to be the costs for people that were rather significant as well, in that, you know, as we talked about with the whole idea of vision killers, they were going to have to change. People who were used to walking to church in our neighborhood church before were now going to have to drive. Yeah, it wasn't far. It was only 3 or 4 miles. But they were going to have to drive on Sunday morning, and that would upset their normal routines. And we've talked earlier about how important routines are. And so that was going to be a price to pay. And then he talked about the fact that the program was going to be different just because it was. I mean, this time we were in multiple services, and as we built this new building, which was going to have seating for 1,500, and was going to have a youth area, and was going to have a large children's building, and there was going to be a preschool with it, that the patterns were going to change. Worship times were going to change. Some of our worship was going to be tweaked differently because now we had this stage with a large auditorium, and that was going to affect the kind of band we would put on stage or the kind of music we would have, and the discussion about whether we'd have an organ or not, and et cetera, et cetera. All of these kind of things that were going to be upsetting to people, that were going to be need great leadership in order to keep the vision going, especially the idea that we were going to relocate twice. We were going to move from our building, the original building of the church, we're going to sell that and move into a temporary housing situation. I've talked about that before. And so that was a cost, and history would tell us, and people's experiences would tell us, that there were going to be losses each step of that way. And so we looked at each of those, and at the end of the conversation, I just remember him looking at me and saying, Bruce, you better not do this. Unless you have a fire in your belly for it. Unless you are passionate about this. Because otherwise, this is going to burn you out. Now, you know, I've shared earlier about some of my reactions to that time fulfilling this vision. But today I want to talk about what are some of those prices that you have to pay for the vision to become reality. They are your prices, nobody else's. Everybody else has a price to pay as well. But these are going to be yours. The first is going all in. John Maxwell is somebody who's known in leadership circles, and he puts it this way: people buy into the vision after the leader buys into it. Now, I began to realize the truth of that very soon. People were looking to me. Now, in the tradition I come from, the pastor, they try to protect a little bit from things like raising money, so that we aren't identified with raising money. And so we had, as we built the whole process, we tried to make my job the vision and somebody else the asking for money. And so I would go around in some of the fundraising things we were doing. We did small groups in houses where various people would gather together and have dessert together. And then I would show up, and I would show up with other church leaders and the consultant. Then, and my job would be to give the vision, to talk about the difference this was going to make in the lives of children and youth and adults, and the fact that this was going to bless this community, and the fact that God was going to use this powerfully. My job was vision. Then they would come and say, you know what, this is going to cost a lot, and this is what we want you to consider. How can you sacrifice in order to become a part of this great vision that we have for the future? What are ways you can sacrifice? Gave ideas to them, gave guidelines to them about how much we were going to need, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so I didn't talk about the money at all, but I was the vision speaker. And on Sundays, when we would talk about it, we did series of messages. I did one from Nehemiah, did one from Ezra about, the whole idea of relocation, of building, let's arise and build. I was the one identified. It was my thing. It was my thing. And there's a price that comes with that, that I can't do what I mentioned last time. I can't talk negatively about it, even though I want to identify with those who have questions and concerns and are traditionalists or are complacent or are fearful. I can't identify with them publicly because people have to see me bought into the vision. In fact, the consultant recommended very quickly that I and my wife make a very big sacrificial pledge, 3-year pledge to this building program. Says when people saw that I was bought in, they would buy in too. People are buying into the process after you buy into it. And so that's a price you're going to have to pay. You're just going to have to pay it. That's all there is to it. Another price you're going to have to pay is physical, emotional, spiritual, financial. I put down there the example of Karen Bennett. I was rereading in preparation for this class Andy Stanley's good book. It's called Visioneering, in which he covers all kinds of topics around visioning and envisioning. But here he tells the story of Karen Bennett. Karen Bennett was a member of his church in Atlanta, Georgia. And she was somebody who was in her 20s and was living as a fairly typical 20-year-old. But she had gotten involved with a ministry that was an inner-city ministry in Atlanta. And as a result, she began to get a vision for what could possibly be there. They began taking care of kids. That was their ministry down there in the inner city. And so as she began to look at her life, she realized that, before this, her goals were kind of, as he says, the next purchase of the Gucci bag and something greater than the Honda that she was driving. But this is the way Stanley put it. But the emptiness she saw in the eyes of those children was something she could not ignore. As her vision began to take shape, she became convinced that there should be a safe place for children in the middle of what was and continues to be a drug-infested war zone. So Karen and her friends decided to plant a children's church in the inner city. After allowing the idea to incubate for several months, they began looking for a site. And now here's Karen's reflection. Month after month, we kept going down there until we felt like it was time to have a church building for those kids. We started looking at old warehouses and old buildings in downtown Atlanta. Finally, we found this one old nightclub that sits right in the middle of 25 major inner city projects. I called the owner up and I said, well, how much do you want for this place? And he said he needed $2,000 a month rent. Well, he could have told me it was $2 million. I didn't have that type of money. I was on a church salary living in an apartment in the suburbs. But on the way home, we each stopped by our bank and cleared out our checking and savings account. We looked for every nickel and dime we could find. That night, we dumped it all into one pot, and between all six of us, we had $52. She began contacting other churches that maybe would support her in the process, and nobody seemed interested. So now she started to pay the price. It was one thing to get the vision with her and her friends, but now the price comes. This is how she describes it. It ended up that my staff and I got together that night, and we just talked about it. It was one of those nights that we just had to be honest with ourselves. Is this what we were going to do? Or was this one of those things that we were just going to talk about until we were 40 or 50 years old? So we decided that we were going to take a chance. Because every once in a while, you've just got to do that. The next day, we went to our landlords and we handed in our notices to the leases on our apartments. We couldn't afford to have our nice apartments and have a church for those kids at the same times. And 2 weeks later, she and her friends moved into that nightclub. She described it this way. I remember that when we moved in, it was 20 or 30 degrees outside, and it was about 20 or 30 degrees inside. We forgot to check if the building had heat before we moved in. It didn't have heat, and it didn't have air conditioning. It didn't have a toilet or a sink or a shower. It didn't have anything. We had to drive down to Hardee's, a fast food place, to use the bathroom. Our new home came complete with cement floors and 17-inch sewer rats. We called them gophers up our way because they go for you. We kept on trying to get the building upgraded, but nobody believed in us. Our parents thought we'd lost our minds. Sometimes you wonder if you've really heard from God or not. They continued to each week dump their paychecks from their other jobs into a pot, and they would take $20 a week each out for their own personal expenses. They had a vision. They had a dream. They began living it out, and as Stanley says at the time of this writing, today Karen and her 16-member staff minister to over 3,000 children every week in multiple weekend services. They sponsor a youth service that draws over 200 teenagers. They established a private school in the community. The tuition is $20 per month. They have 125 students enrolled and over 500 on a waiting list. Now, when Karen talks about those times of, you know, is this going to be real or not? Am I willing to pay the price or not? She says she really feels like it was a test from God. Was she really willing to go forward? So that's a price you're going to have to pay. A third price is simply this. The critics will come. Now, I've shown you this bell curve before, of how people respond to new ideas and how they respond to visions. I'll just run through it again to remind you that 2.5% of the population are considered to be innovators. In other words, if there's a new idea, they'll grab onto it. They are the ones who are waiting in line for the new iPhone. They're the ones who are buying the new product. They are ones that are checking out this new model of automobile. They're innovators. They want what's new. And advertisers know this group well because they advertise everything is new and improved, right? And so they want what's new. If there's a new kind of soap, I want to try that. Innovators. The early adopters are close behind them at 13.5%. These are the people who are saying, okay, I heard about that. I really want to do it. You know, I remember, you know, when the internet was being developed, I'm old enough to remember that, and how quickly my children caught on to this whole stuff and how quickly they adopted. They were early adopters. I was probably part of the early majority or maybe even a late majority. But they grab onto it because, oh, hey, it's new, and look at the needs, and look at how neat this could be. The early majority of a new idea are those ones that will come on board when they understand why something is being done. When they understand your vision, when they understand the vision of your organization, they'll be on board. They'll give financially. They're early adopters. Late majority are those people, 34% again, who will come in, but only after it's proven. You know, that's why the short wins are so important, as we're going to be talking about, as we have talked about and going to talk about in change theory, to have short wins. These people, when they short-term wins, when people see that it's working, the late adopters will come on board. Then there's the laggards, 16%, who maybe will come on board, maybe not. And a percentage, which nobody has put on them that I've seen, are going to be critics. These are people who are going to look at what you're doing, and their response is going to criticize it. Now, criticism hurts. It just does. You know, you've seen the interview a little while ago of my good friend Frank Weavers, and how somebody said that they, you know, in effect said, "I wish you were dead," you know, saying this is the coffin for our pastor. As the church was going through the dramatic changes of a relocation, that cuts deeply. I remember the day when one of the critics had spoken to someone else who felt like they had to share it with me. Now, I heard my critics fairly often and fairly well, you know, through email, through mail, etc. But it still would cut deeply. And this time the critic said, as we were looking at relocation, looking at building a large church facility, the critic said to someone else, says, "Bruce is just trying to build his own kingdom." Wow. Now, the person who felt like they had to share that with me, I don't know why, sent me into a tailspin for a while. Because, as with any criticism, you try to identify, is there a nugget of truth here? Is there some truth that I have to be aware of? There some truth that I have to address here? And so I had to look at that carefully, and I had to say, am I? You know, am I, because of my baggage, because of my personality, because of my need to succeed, am I really about building my own kingdom? Is this God's vision? But I'd been through a lot of that, and so very quickly came to the idea that, no, that's not who I am. That's not what I'm trying to do. I firmly believe that Jesus Christ is calling us to take these steps now so that we can reach more people for Him, so that we can make a greater impact among the poor of our community, so that we can affect the character of our community by having Christians who are growing in their faith engaged in various ways. But then it still sits there. Now, one practice, I'll tell you, if you're in a church or an organization, some people will try to send you letters. And they will be unsigned because they don't want to own it. I very, very quickly developed a pretty sharp principle. And that was, if the letter is unsigned, I would glance at a letter. If it was unsigned, it went into the trash. I would not give it the time of day. In fact, just an aside, that was when I quit having evaluations of staff contain anonymous statements by people. I used to send out for staff, you know, oh, so-and-so, we're looking at making them as efficient as they can be and as great as they can be for the kingdom of God. Can you give us some response about what their strengths or weaknesses and suggestions for them? And it was anonymous. And after that, I said, they don't need to know who said it, but I need to know who said it. It cannot be anonymous. People have to own their critique. That just seems to me a principle in the kingdom of God. We're going to talk about that when we talk about conflict later. Conflict, it's a reality. Now, it's fascinating when you look in Scripture that Nehemiah becomes an incredible model of this. Remember in chapter 4, his plan of rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem are seen as a threat. Sanballat, Tobiah, the other people around there begin to see this as a great threat. And so they're even suggesting that they're going to sneak among them, they're going to attack, and they're going to kill them and destroy the people who are rebuilding the building. This is after mocking them and saying, yeah, building's such a fragile thing, it'll fall down. If even a fox were to run on top of it, it's just going to fall apart. And so all of those kinds of things. How would Nehemiah respond? He even got a letter one time saying, I want to meet with you in such and such a place. And you know, Nehemiah was able to sense that this was not of God, first of all, but that they were actually going to try to harm him. They were that seriously threatened by the new vision of this walled city that was going to exist in Jerusalem. And so how did he respond? Well, first of all, he prayed. He remembered the source of the vision, and he revised his plan. He prayed. This is his prayer. Hear, O our God, how we are despised. Return their reproach on their own heads, and give them up for plunder in a land of captivity. Do not forgive their iniquity, and let not their sin be blotted out before you, for they have demoralized the builders. Now, that's a powerful prayer. I don't think we'd pray that in New Testament days. God, don't ever forgive them for what they're doing here. I mean, We're to be people of grace, and we're to respond to critics with grace as well, and certainly mercy and forgiveness and all those good things. But he is identifying here a very real thing about this kind of price to be paid, and that is, it can demoralize people. It can demoralize you, but it can demoralize the people who are involved sacrificing and the people who are working hard to make the vision a reality. When they hear the critics, they're going to look at how do you respond. And so I find it a real powerful thing that he responded with prayer. He did not defend himself. He didn't go to these people and say, oh, no, you've got it wrong. I never took that chance to get up in front on Sunday morning and say, you know what, somebody's accused me of trying to build my own kingdom. No, that's not true. Didn't defend himself. He went to prayer. And he let God be the one who was going to determine how that price was met. But he was going to pay the price of dealing with the fact that the critics will come. Then he spent time remembering the source of the vision. In fact, this is the way he put it. So when I saw their fear, that is the workers, I rose and spoke to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people. Do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord who is great and awesome, and fight for your daughters, your sons, your brothers, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your houses. Remember. Remember, God is in this. He had previously recited all the wonderful things God had done and how the hand of God had been with him as he walked this way to create this vision for a new wall around Jerusalem. How God had supplied through the kings, not only letting him go to be the leader in this, but paying for it as well. So remember, when the price starts coming home in any of these ways, it's a time when you remember, you reflect on the vision God has given you. You think about, is this really God's vision? And the answer almost always will be yes. And then you say, okay, Lord, I am your servant. I think of Paul. My wife and I are reading Acts right now in our devotions. And as he's going to Jerusalem, God has told him he's going to testify in Rome, as he's testified elsewhere. And the prophets are coming as he's getting closer and closer to Jerusalem. And Agabus in particular becomes one who ties up his hands with Paul's belt. And so the Spirit says, the one who owns this belt is going to be tied up like this. And, you know, that's a huge price to pay, right? I mean, Paul has been traveling all over that area of the world sharing the good news. He's been faithful in his mission to be the great evangelist. And now he's looking at imprisonment. But what he said was, whoa, I'm ready to give my life if that's what's required. I met Jesus. And he gave me this vision of a church that would begin expanding throughout the world. And I'm willing to do anything for it. So I remember that God called him. He remembered that first thing. In fact, he recites that often, the time when Jesus met him on the road and he started to get a vision. What God told to Ananias was, Jesus said to Ananias, you know, I'm showing him how much he is going to suffer for my sake. He knew it going in, that there was a price to pay, but he was willing to give himself entirely. So remember the source of the vision, and then choose your pain. I like that phrase just because that comes from a friend of mine. They were going through changes. The church he was part of had been on decline for many years. And so they were instituting changes as he came there. And they were changing worship. They were changing times. They were changing, even talking about changing location, a variety of things. And one time talking with him, we would meet for prayer together at that time, he and I, about a variety of things. And so we were praying about this one time. And I said, boy, how are you doing? You know, how are you doing with all of this? And he said, well, he said, I realize I get to choose my pain. He said, my pain before was people leaving the church. And they were leaving because we weren't relevant. And they were leaving because, you know, the music didn't meet their expectations. It wasn't relevant. It was very traditional music. But they were leaving for a variety of reasons. He said, I could live with that pain, or I could choose the pain of making changes that will allow them to be retained and more like these people to be coming in and making a greater impact for the kingdom. But the pain is still there because the critics are there. Choose your pain. And then Nehemiah revised his plan. But we prayed to our God, and because of them we set up a guard against them day and night. okay, the plan's going along, they've got the rebuilding teams, but now there's this glitch, there's this threat to what they're doing. So he says, okay, we've got to set a guard now. So they changed things, that some of the people were working, some were standing guard, and they revised their plan. So, be open to change. Don't confuse your plan with the vision. Sometimes you're going to have to revise it, and that's a price you're going to have to pay. So, just want to conclude with words of Robert Schuller, you know, a longtime leader, builder of the Crystal Cathedral in Southern California. He was often criticized within the church, criticized by Christians. He just dealt with criticism almost all of his life. But he responded once. I was in a seminar where he was speaking, and somebody asked, how are you dealing with this? Because the church community in general was condemning how much it cost to build that Crystal Cathedral, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And his response was, I would rather attempt something great and fail than do nothing and succeed. I'm going to say that again. There's a price to pay, but it's a worthwhile price. I would rather attempt something great and fail, or do nothing and succeed. Now, in our contexts, whatever yours is, attempt something great. Yeah, it's going to cost something from you. It will. It's going to cost something. But the reward is going to be incredible as far as living out a vision God has given you in building His kingdom. And so much so that you can look back when you end your life and you meet Jesus Christ and hear Him say, well done, good and faithful servant. You've been faithful in a few things, and it was costly. But I'm going to put you over many. That's what I'm looking forward to. That's why I'm willing to risk.